This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There are reports of record turnouts in states with early voting and complaints of long lines, seemingly endless waits, and already both political parties charge the other side plans to steal the election. Democrats level accusations of systematic efforts to purge voting rolls, suppress turnout, and disqualify legal voters. Republicans charge that record numbers of new voter registrations include large numbers of frauds. So after the dangling chads and butterfly ballots 8 years ago and the problems with provisional ballots and new machines 4 years ago, can we trust the election of 2008? What do you see where you live? What's your biggest concern come voting day? 800-989-8255 is the phone number. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, legend has it that hemlines rise and fall with the economy, down in bad years, up when times are good. Email us your personal economic index. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, can we trust this election? And we begin with Daniel Takagi. He's an associate professor at Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University. He's served as counsel for groups from both parties that have filed friend of the court briefs in several of the cases in this election season and joins us now from the studios at Ohio State University in Columbus. Nice to have you on the program today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And let's start with the allegations of purging. First of all, what is it and how widespread is it?
Well, purging has to do with the way that voter registration lists are maintained. And voter registration has become the big issue of the 2008 election, just as voting machines, as we all remember from Florida 2000, were the big issue of that election, and provisional ballots were the big issue of 2004. Voter registration is the issue that everyone is talking about in terms of the way that elections are conducted. And purging has to do with the practice of deleting certain voters' names from the list. Now, there are certain circumstances in which purging is perfectly okay, and federal law sets out a method by which voters may be purged under certain circumstances if they haven't voted in two consecutive federal elections, basically for a two-year period.
Or maybe if they die or move out of state. That would be another
reason. Yeah. Precisely. If they die, move out of state, and one of the purging issues that has been especially controversial in recent elections is the purging of felons in those states that disenfranchise people with felony convictions. The problems come when states either don't follow the law or adopt careless practices for striking voters from their lists. And the net result of that can be that eligible voters wrongly have their names omitted from voting lists.
And the New York Times ran a story this year that suggested that, in fact, a lot more eligible voters have been stricken from lists than new voters in some states.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, overall, voter registration data across the country showed that between 2004 and 2006, the number of registered voters actually went down. Now, I suspect we'll see a sharp uptick in this election, but there is a real risk that when states apply aggressive purging practices, as they've been in some cases sued by the United States Department of Justice to make them do, we're going to have problems and we're going to have voters whose names are taken off the list wrongly.
And is this evidence of some vast conspiracy, either right or left wing?
Well, conspiracy may be too strong a word, but I don't think there's any question that both a long-standing tradition of American history and one that's continued to the present date, the parties will always try to game the system to their advantage. Now, some methods of doing that are, of course, perfectly acceptable. Each side in every election tries to register voters of its own party and voters likely to vote for its candidates. Unfortunately, what we've seen throughout American history and continuing until the present day is sometimes parties try to manipulate voter registration lists or otherwise rig the system so as to make it more difficult for the other side's voters to get out there and vote.
There is also the allegation widespread in Republican circles this year that large numbers of ineligible voters are, in fact, being registered illegally.
Right. And on this point, it's especially important to distinguish between two different things. On the one hand, there's registration fraud, and on the other hand, there's voter fraud. Now, registration fraud typically refers to phony registration forms being filled out on behalf of non-existent voters. And typically this happens when a voter registration group, and ACORN has been the example that's come up most often in this election, hires canvassers to go out and register voters for it. And sometimes those canvassers won't do the work they're being paid to do. Well, occasionally submit registration forms with names such as Mickey Mouse and Dick Tracy on them, and those get turned into ACORN or the other voter registration groups out there. Now, Mickey Mouse's name may appear on a voter registration form, but there's little or no evidence that Mickey Mouse has actually walked through the polling place door trying to vote. And that would be voter fraud if someone who was not eligible to vote attempted to vote or attempted to double vote using a fictitious name. But voter fraud is extremely rare based on the evidence we have.
So, in other words, even if there are fraudulent voters registered, they don't vote.
Right. Even if there are, and I wouldn't even call them fraudulent voters, I would say the names of non-existent people on the voter rolls, they very rarely, if ever, show up and try to vote. And the reasons for that are obvious. Somebody's taking a big risk if he or she goes to the polls pretending to be someone that he or she is not, the risk of criminal prosecution and doing time for a felony.
It's also hard to run away in one of those rodent suits, so it's...
Right. That also makes it difficult.
Let's see if we can get some callers in on the conversation. We're talking with Daniel Takagi, an expert on elections law and an associate professor of law at Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Rosemary. Rosemary with us on the line from Princeton in New Jersey.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
As you said, I live in New Jersey, and as a voter in New Jersey, I feel completely insecure, which adds to my general insecurity about the vote in our country in general, because we vote primarily on these electronic voting machines and the Sequoia machines, which we purchased at great expense with very little research into them, now have proven to be, after they were studied by Professors Appel and Felton at Princeton University, you know, quite corruptible. These machines are delivered to polling places well ahead of the election. They're totally unguarded. And it seems that, you know, we're sort of in an era of non-accountability. The Fed seems non-accountable. Wall Street seems non-accountable. The Bush administration will go away without being
accountable. Well, let's stick to the election for the moment, Rosemary,
yeah, so
please.
My feeling is that, you know, my own anxiety about the election, I think, is kind of a general malaise that we have, you know, throughout our country at this time.
Daniel Takagi, is she right to be worried about these machines?
Well, I think the caller, Rosemary, is right to focus on the question of accountability and put specifically in the voting context on transparency. But I think it's wrong to assume that the only problems with that lie with electronic voting equipment. The truth is we've got lots of examples from American history of electoral manipulation by insiders with paper ballots. Now, it is certainly theoretically possible that someone could tamper with software on electronic voting machines and thereby distort the results. The solution, whether we're talking about paper or electronic voting systems, is to have good procedures in place to make sure there's transparency from beginning to end, to have adequate testing, and to make sure that poll workers are trained on what to look out for.
But excuse me. Can I interrupt for a second?
Go ahead, Rosemary.
New Jersey have no paper trail. And so, whereas you say, I agree with you completely in terms of the things that have to be in place, preparation for poll workers and all of that. But, you know, one is operating in the dark if there is no way to verify the election. And we, you know, asked our governor to give us the opportunity to vote on paper back in April. He said that, you know, the state has budgetary issues. In my estimation, when you are not operating in the light, and I think Mark Crispin Miller has done a lot of research on this, Some of these machines report to a central location. I'm not a computer expert, and I don't understand which, you know, is not exactly secure. And so I don't disagree with you. I agree completely that there are many other, you know, paper might be, I wouldn't think as corruptible, but let's just say for the sake of argument that it is.
History suggests it's more so, but anyway.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, we don't know that because the last two elections were very questionable on, you know, a number of levels. So my point is just that any time you do something in the dark, whether it's banking or voting, or, you know, there's a sort of a scuro part to it, you know, how can one feel secure? You know, these are after all, as machines, they are technology.
Rosemary, now I'm going to interrupt you to give Daniel a chance to respond.
Yeah, I get the concern, and I think the bottom line solution is that you've got to have transparency.
Right.
You've got to have procedures in place that will ensure that the equipment, hardware and software, will adequately be tested. I also agree if you're leaving voting equipment unsupervised, just as would be the case if you were leaving a ballot box unsupervised, you're inviting problems. What I disagree with is the suggestion that the paper trail is the solution or even a good solution. We've had pretty bad experiences with some of the paper trail equipment out there. For example, in Cleveland, we had a pretty lousy paper trail system where 20%, 10 to 20% of the paper replicas of the electronic ballot were actually compromised. You'd be better off using the electronic ballots as your official ballot of record rather than the paper replicas as Ohio law now requires. So we should be careful what we wish for.
Rosemary, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Stay with us. We're going to talk about concerns about fraud and voter suppression in the presidential election. Can you trust this election? Tell us what you're seeing, 800-989-8255. Also send us email, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Cownan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cownan in Washington. It's not just voters who are gearing up for the presidential election. So are squadrons of lawyers and poll watchers on both sides. Election officials expect a huge turnout this year, which could mean long lines, problems with voting machines, and challenges to individual voters. Nobody expects a repeat of what happened in 2000, but can you trust this election? What's your biggest concern come voting day? What do you see going on where you live? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guest is Daniel Takagi, Associate Professor of Law at Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University, who's been involved with several of the cases in this election season. And here's an email we have from Lisa in Minneapolis. In Minneapolis, the biggest concern I have for my neighborhood is that long lines deter people from voting. I've heard several people say they don't know how, between work and family commitments, they're going to be able to find time to wait in line for over an hour to vote. Understaffing in certain places is a subtle but powerful way to prohibit voting. And that's a concern not just in Minneapolis, Daniel.
Yeah, it certainly is, and especially in urban areas. In past elections, we have seen significant lines. In Columbus, Ohio, where I live, some voters waited for 2 hours, sometimes even more, to vote last time around. Now, here's the good news. I think there is reason to believe, it's at least in some places, especially in some of the swing states where we've had heavy turnout in past elections, that the lines won't be as bad as they were in past elections. That's true for a couple of big reasons. One of them is that we've seen an increasing move towards early voting. That includes both mail-in absentee ballots as well as in-person early voting. And, you know, here in Ohio, we've got early voting centers throughout the state starting 35 days before the election. And anecdotal evidence suggests that those have been very heavily used. And the big advantage of early voting is it can take the pressure off the polling place on election day. The other thing that's changed, at least to some extent, is that in some places we've got new voting machines and more voting machines in place than we had in 2004. And this new equipment, and this relates in part to the prior caller's question, actually does save lost votes. And to the extent we've got more machines in place than we did in 2004, that may cut down on lines. The bottom line is no one should be discouraged or deterred from showing up to vote on November 4th by long lines. And you should check to see whether you're in a state that allows you to vote early. And I'd encourage voters to avail themselves of that opportunity if it's there for you.
An email on that point from Bonnie in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. In 1998, the state of Wisconsin, of Oregon rather, passed the Oregon Ballot Measure 60, which made their state the first in the country to vote completely by mail. In 2000, the presidential election was conducted in Oregon entirely by mail with about 80% participation. The Oregon system resolves most issues with questionable ballots before the election and gets them resolved so that everybody's votes can be counted. Other benefits other than increased voter participation is less voter fraud, and it costs less to conduct an election. So why aren't other states going to this system, and why is it that we never hear about this as an option? Maybe that's an issue for another day. But in any case, let's get another voice in the conversation. Joining us now, Lenny McAllister, a political commentator who appears on Fox News Rising. He also writes for several online magazines, including TheRoot.com, where he recently wrote an op-ed titled Polarized Mistrust. And he joins us now from member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Nice to have you on the program today.
Good afternoon, Neil. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And in this, in your op-ed, you say the real risk in this election is voter suspicion, not voter fraud. What do you mean by that?
Well, I just think that we're at a point in time in our political history where we don't trust each other at all. And the system that was put in place by our founding fathers was one where the secret ballot was sacred and gave us an opportunity to really voice our true opinion. And without that trust that we have to have in the system that all votes are going to be counted equally and be given true measure and true weight, we are at risk of losing what our democracy is supposed to be all about.
Well, are both sides right to be suspicious? There have been signs of chicanery from both sides in the past.
Yes, I think that at this point in time, both sides have a right to be suspicious, but it's going to take both sides after this election. Obviously, it's not going to happen. To me, it's not going to happen within the next 10 days or so. We're going to have to really move forward starting in 2009 to rebuild that trust so that we can maximize our political system.
And you also write specifically about black voters who have been notoriously skeptical of the electoral system.
Yes, and a lot of times it's because we've created an us versus them without having the political diversity that African Americans need to have with Republicans and Democrats. You automatically build up an us versus them if you have it weighted so that 95% of a certain segment of America is on one side or the other. You don't know that much about the other side, and therefore if anything goes awry, the first thing that you're more inclined to do is be skeptical, be suspicious, and keep that mistrust going. And it doesn't just stay within one election cycle. We're still hearing about the ghost of 2000 here in 2008.
Mm-hmm. And there are also likely to be unprecedented numbers of African-American voters this year.
Absolutely. And there should be. I mean, this is a historical election, and the goal, as far as I'm concerned, even as an African-American Republican, is for those African-Americans, for our community to stay involved politically and then from there diversify in what I like to call diversify our political stock to make sure that we are equally represented on both sides of the aisle moving forward.
That's an idea. At least 90% of the African-American vote especially expected to go to the Democratic candidate this year.
And that's not an exception. That happens every single year for the most part. It's just going to happen more so because Senator Obama is on the ticket. But ideally, moving forward, when you start looking at these local elections that here in the Charlotte area will occur next year, when you start looking at the midterm elections that will happen in 2010, we'll start seeing more of a political diverse identity from black America and one that stays engaged in the process.
If Senator Obama should be elected president this year, would you expect that African Americans will be more active politically than they have in the past?
I hope so. But if we look at the examples that we find when we have black mayors and when we have black governors, it does not necessarily mean that African Americans are going to stay engaged in the process. And that's the fear that I have personally, is that we're going to have a sense of euphoria for a period of time, and then we're going to slide back into the empathy thinking that, oh, well, Senator Obama looks out for the everyday person. We don't have to stay involved. This is still a human being. We're going to have to still stay engaged because the government's supposed to represent us, not do things for us. We're going to have to make sure that we do not infuse that same attitude that we've done when we've got our first black mayors 40, 35 years ago and what we've done with some of the black governors that we've had over the last 20 years. We cannot have that same attitude towards having the first African-American president if he's elected on November 4th.
Well, thanks, Lenny McAllister, very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lenny McAllister, a political commentator for Fox News Rising. There's a link to his op-ed on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. With us today from member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Let's see if we get another caller on the line for Daniel Dukaji. And this is Hannah. Hannah with us from Johnson County in Iowa.
Yes, hello. I love the show.
Thank you.
We recently have eliminated the electronic voting devices that tabulate here in Johnson County. I'm a former elections technician. I'm actually currently running for the auditor's seat. And I found that the voters really appreciated that we are no longer using the devices that tabulate. We've moved to an AutoMark device, which simply prints the ovals in for the voters, and then that is taken and fed into the tabulator, which has a paper trail. I know you've already talked about the voting equipment, but I'm just hearing from voters that they really like the switch here in Johnson County. The big concern that I'm hearing about, though, is the implementation of Election Day registration, and the concern is for the potential that someone could vote theoretically 57 times, hence the number of precincts we have, because, you know...
Oh, there's no way to cross-check the list.
Precisely. That's a big concern that I'm hearing about. I wonder if your guest wanted to comment on that.
Yeah. Well, that's always the argument that is made against Election Day registration. But if you look at the evidence, it's not founded. First of all, Election Day registration, which nine states now have, can result and does result in a significant increase in participation, somewhere on the order of 5 to 10%. And that's huge in the area of voting. Now, in terms of the fraud concern, that's the argument that's always made. But if you look at states that have had Election Day registration, and three of them have been studied extensively because they've had it for over 30 years, you don't find evidence of increased fraud. And the reason for that is it's very difficult to register in multiple places and produce the identification that you have to do to register on Election Day and not get caught. And if you do get caught, you're at risk of being prosecuted for a felony. So there's no evidence that fraud is more common in Election Day registration states than in other states.
Okay.
Hannah, thank you. Good luck,
thank you
by the way.
Much. I appreciate it.
Here's an email from Pam in St. Louis. Question, with the enactment of motor voter laws and the ease of registering to vote, why is it necessary to hire groups and organizations to register people, and why are not volunteers used?
The reason why it's necessary to hire groups like ACORN, like the League of Women Voters, to do voter registration is because not everybody gets reached through these other means of registering voters. Our system depends very heavily on private registration efforts. Now, we could go to a different kind of system, one like Canada has, in which the government actually takes affirmative responsibility for going out to register everyone. And in Canada, we've got 93% of eligible citizens registered compared to just 68% here in the United States. The political will, however, hasn't been there to implement a universal registration type system like Canada's in the U.S. This would also, however, cut down on these concerns about registration fraud, because if the government took over registration, we wouldn't need, or at least wouldn't need to the same extent, these private groups to go out and register voters who maybe don't drive or for some other reason aren't reached through other means. But as long as our system depends as heavily as it does on private groups, we're going to have some of these problems like the ones that have been highly publicized in the last few weeks.
Email from Mike in Cincinnati. We have an issue here in Cincinnati, Ohio, that is in Hamilton County. Our county prosecutor, Joe Dieters, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, wanted to seize and separate over 600 votes that were cast from between September 30th and October 6th. I think that was the one-week period where you could register and vote on the same day. He wants these votes not counted until they are investigated for fraud. What makes this a controversy is that he's the campaign chairman for McCain-Palin in Cincinnati. There's always been an outlash at this guy. Now there is even more than ever. And to be fair, the official in charge of elections in the state of Ohio is a Democrat. And that's, is this a conflict of interest to have people running for these offices where they're running for, as members of one party or another, and then they're in charge of elections?
Yeah, I'm very familiar with the situation in the Cincinnati area, and in fact, I joined a letter with voting and civil rights groups opposing the action that Mr. Dieters took in Hamilton County. That's the Cincinnati area here in Ohio. I think it is a real problem when officials, especially partisan officials, take actions that could reasonably be interpreted as an attempt to intimidate voting or registration and thereby to suppress the vote. And to my mind, the actions that were taken in the Cincinnati area raise serious concerns under the Voting Rights Act and other voting rights laws. And I think we have good reason to be worried about that.
We're talking with Daniel Takagi, an associate professor of law at Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University, about, allegations by both sides that the other guys are trying to steal this election. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Sandy. Sandy with us from Milford in New Hampshire.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm actually very concerned about overall control at the polls. Just let me tell you how it works in my hometown when I go to vote. I basically walk up to the column with my last name, the initial for my last name, A to D, whatever, and I basically say my name. I'm never asked for identification, and I'm handed a ballot, and I go and I vote. Now, my concern with this is that I could go and say I'm anybody, or anyone could come into my hometown and just look down on that list and say, see that there's no tick next to your name, say, that's me, yes, get the ballot. I'm also aware of an individual whose wife is not a U.S. citizen, was able to vote in a prior presidential election. And I also know of another family that moved to New Hampshire from Massachusetts and remained on the Massachusetts polling list, as well as the New Hampshire, in my hometown, where they were able to register to vote. So these kinds of controls, we can joke about Mickey Mouse or Dick Tracy and nobody would ever come up. But let me tell you, it doesn't work. Anybody can come in and look at five names on a list and go off and say that that's who they are, or to tell the next guy that that's who they are. I'll take a response off the air because I would like to hear and have my husband hear it as well.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Sandy.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Well, I'm glad the caller asked this question. There's a lot of talk out there about voter fraud and a lot of anecdotes out there. But if you actually look at the evidence, voter fraud is extremely rare. And the best check that can be done is just to have a signature match. Voter fraud is rare in part because the voter's taking a big risk if he or she goes to the polls pretending to be someone that he or she is not. And unfortunately, what we've seen in the last few years is attempts to exaggerate these sorts of incidents that the caller described. And look, I don't deny that they occasionally happen, but they're very rare. Exaggerate these instances in an effort to enact new barriers to participation or stringent purging procedures like the ones that we've seen get some attention in the last few weeks, the net effect of which can be to exclude eligible voters from voting and to distort the political process, especially by excluding groups like poor people, minority voters, people with disabilities, and elderly voters who, for example, are much less likely to have a driver's license or other forms of government-issued photo ID. So I think that is the big thing we should be most worried about.
And just a couple of pieces of advice. We just have a very little time left, but vote early if you can. Check to see that you are registered and have not been purged if you can. Are those good things to do?
Those are great things to do. And let me give you a couple your listeners a couple sources of information. If you're interested in tracking the litigation and controversies that are going on in the world of election law, you can try our website at Ohio State, electionlaw.osu.
And we'll put a link to that on our website at npr.org/talkofthenation. So,
And for voters who want election protection information, 866-OUR-VOTE.
This final email we got from Debbie in Jacksonville, Florida. Florida has a website dedicated to listing all early voters' names. This list can be checked to verify that your ballot was cast for early voting, keeping a check and balance. It also shows the total early votes. The count on the list should equal the total counts votes counted. If you have voted early, your name should be on this list and the totals should match. And by the way, she adds, Mickey Mouse has not voted early, at least not yet. Daniel Takagi, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel Takagi, Associate Professor of Law at Moritz College of Law. There's a link to his blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And again, we'll get that website on our website for you. He joined us today from the studios at The Ohio State University in Columbus. Up next, slow tunes sell well in recessions, peppy ones when times are good. The new updated Hemline Index, one indicator tells you the economy is bad. Send us an email, talk@npr.org, and stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In economics, there's no shortage of abstruse theories. There is, for example, the theory of comparative advantage. The dismal science centers on dependency theory, international trade theory, and game theory, which economists tell me is nowhere near as much fun as it sounds. Well, here's one that's easy to understand. It's known as the Hemline Index. Almost a century ago, an economist drew a correlation between the economy and women's skirts. Basically, women's skirts get longer as the economy gets slower and economic health of the country rises. Well, you get the idea. Tamar Lewin, a reporter for The New York Times, set out to locate the modern Hemline Index, the indicators the economy is doing well or maybe not so well, the tempo of pop tunes, candy sales, what indicator tells you the economy is bad or good, what is your Hemline Index? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. As always, you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation, where you'll also find a link to Tamar Lewin's piece. And now the New York Times reporter joins us from our bureau in New York City. Tamar, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Neil.
How does the Hemline Index stand?
Well, the Hemline Index is not looking too good these days. In all kinds of ways. I don't know that hemlines is really it. And actually, a lot of people have shifted from hemlines to cleavage as the thing that they look at.
Really? And is it up or down, good or bad?
Oh, well, more covered up is bad times and less covered up is good times.
We got this email from Jody in Brooks City base in Texas. And she says about the Hemline Index, I gave up, I wear pants.
I think that's a great idea.
Laxative sales go up during a recession?
So says Leo Shapiro, who has been tracking consumer buying for, I don't know, 70 years or something amazing. And he says people, you know, are just holding themselves back. And so laxatives naturally go up. And he says in good times, it's deodorants that go up because everybody's out dancing and sweating.
Really?
I don't know.
And there are arguments that some things, sales of some items go down in a recession. You'd think, you know, luxury goods, that sort of thing.
Some do. People look for the cheaper alternatives. But some things like candy, which are a sort of a cheap indulgence, do very, very well.
And you note that just recently, Hershey Foods, which makes a lot of candy, reported good sales.
Good sales, yes.
Now, carbonated drinks and eggs, and tobacco are vulnerable to recession.
Yeah. Actually, Leo Shapiro's view of this is anything wet people stay away from and they go more for dry stuff, staples, that isn't going to be perishable. So, you know, less fruit, which is expensive, less steak, which is expensive, more rice, more beans.
And there is a curious example you give about beauty and, the Playboy Centerfold Index.
Oh, there is an academic who has spent years and years testing out his economic security hypothesis, which is that in scary times, people look for reassurance. And he's looked at all kinds of things. He looked at Playboy, the Playmate of the Year, and found that she gets less curvy in bad times. You want somebody who seems more grown up and should have more mature features and smaller eyes and, you know, a stronger chin and just less childlike. He looked at movie actresses, and the more popular ones in Bad Times are the less curvy ones, also with the more less childlike features. He also looked at a lot of things. He looked at who you choose as a lab partner when you're feeling threatened. And men will choose a person, a woman, with a more adult kind of features if the man is feeling threatened when he's got to choose his lab partner. And then he looked at music. This one hasn't been published yet, but it's great. He took the 50 number one Billboard songs over 50 years and had a bunch of people rate them for their meaningfulness. And then he looked at their length and the pace and everything. And he found that in Bad Times, we like meaningful songs. And the ones that he particularly liked to talk about were Bridge Over Troubled Waters and That's What a Friend Is For. And we might quibble with this one, Candle in the Wind. But and he found that long, slow songs on meaningful topics do better in years that are bad. And short, bouncy dance tunes like My Sharona and Sugar Shack and, also Macarena, which he found the most meaningless song, but it also did well in a year that was not that great. But in general, that's the correlation.
So peppy tunes in good times and soulful ballads in bad times.
Right.
Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Usually pretty slow.
Right. Very slow.
Here's an email from Mike in Minneapolis. As oil prices soared and commodity prices followed suit, I found my economic barometer in the average price of a 12-pack of my beloved Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. Essentially, over last year, the price of a 12er of PBR has risen more than a dollar and in some cases a solid two. Hopefully, it'll creep back down to $7 ranges as oil prices hopefully continue to fall. I'm not sure that that's a scientific measure, but we'll take that
but
for what it's worth.
But beer does well. Beer does well in bad times.
Alcohol does well or just beer?
Well, more beer than alcohol because beer is, you know, your cheaper version.
Let's get Brian on the line. Brian's calling us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes, how you doing?
All right. What's your economic index?
Well, I deliver vehicles all over the country, you know, a lot of larger trucks and RVs. And recently I've noticed there's I just took a repossessed RV to a repossession lot in Ohio, and this is about a 40-acre lot. And I've taken stuff there a few times a year over the last 5 or 6 years, and at best I've only seen that thing about a quarter full. And when I took this one in just a couple of weeks ago, this lot was packed front to back, bumper to bumper, and the number of specifically high-end RVs had actually about sextupled in the number that were in there. So,
and obviously repossessed because people aren't making their payments.
Yeah, and I think that the housing thing is just a tip of the iceberg. I think this is the next one to fall pretty soon.
Well, that's an interesting. But it makes sense in bad times, Tamar.
Yeah, that's a great one. Combining both the evictions and the high gas prices, it's like a perfect indicator.
Brian, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Here's
an email from Carolyn in Valdosta, Georgia. My hemline index is sports. If I ever see football in financial trouble in the South, then I know the economy is really having trouble. I think she might be right about that. Let's see about John. John with us from Charlottesville in Virginia.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
I own a small business in Charlottesville. We're a lunch restaurant, and we've noticed in the last 15 years when our credit card sales get high in comparison to our cash deposits, things usually slow down in the economy within about 12 weeks. And this summer we had a record cash or credit card to cash deposit, and now it's about evening out. So we're optimistic that by the end of the year, maybe early 2009, things are going to look good again.
And tell us, John, do you have a lot of credit cards that come back as insufficient funds, that their sums are rejected?
You know, we went 12 and a half years with never having a chargeback, and we've had a couple. We've had a couple in the last year. And this past July, we were 80% credit card, 20% cash, and that's never happened before.
Wow.
People are charging $7 lunches. I'm not talking debit cards. I'm talking credit cards. That was shocking to us. But we're about 50-50 right now, 50% cash, 50% credit card.
I'm taking it. I'm running with that to the bank, John.
All right. Look around January. Things will pick up again.
All right. I'll bet on that. Thanks very much. Credit card sales, does that have anything? Tamar, did you find anything about that?
I don't know about that. I do know that my taxi driver just today said his number of calls was now down. His fares were down about 20%, and he was feeling pretty grim. So I think it's really showing up all over the place.
Let's talk with Don. Don with us on the line from Salt Lake City in Utah.
Yeah, I'm actually just going to repeat NPR, back to NPR. I think I heard this on All Things Considered. They were talking about the Phillies being in the playoffs and that they were in the playoffs in 1929 during the Great Depression, and then they won the World Series in 1980 during a recession, and now they're back.
And now they're back. It's also true that every time the Phillies win the World Series, a Republican is elected president. We heard that yesterday from the political junkie Ken Rudin. So I'm not sure twice makes her much of a trend, Don. But
well, thank you.
We'll take that for what it's worth. I don't think there's any quite baseball index, but there was a health index that I found fascinating, Tamar.
Yeah, there's quite a few, and there's a lot of controversy about this because really poverty is not good for people's health. But at the same time, some people have found that in good times, a lot of very healthy things go away. People eat too much, they exercise too little, they work too much, they have more heart attacks. And when things slow down, they start eating better, they start exercising more, there's fewer heart attacks, there's less pollution because they're driving less. All kinds of things. Flu and goes down, lower back pain goes down. But that's the big view. And then other economists point out, yeah, but the guy who lost his job, he's not healthier. And the guy whose business failed, he's not healthier. But it sort of really all depends how you look. But there may be some little glimmers of good stuff in there.
One of the downsides was that the suicide rate tends to go up during bad times.
Yeah, that is true. And nobody has any argument about that one.
Here's an email from Sonia in St. Paul. My economic indicator has always been observing other lawns and gardens in the neighborhood when people feel they have enough extra income. They spend more money and time on landscaping when times are tough. I notice more weeds in lawns and fewer annuals in planters and around homes. That may be true, or she may have just seen my house.
No, I think it's true. And there's also, this is the moment when you turn to perennials.
We're talking with Tamar Lewin, a reporter for The New York Times and author of A Hemline Index Updated. You can find a link to it on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. Let's go to Jennifer. Jennifer with us from Duluth in Minnesota.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a couple of quick things. When the economy has gone south, I'm about to turn 40, so I haven't been doing this for a long time, but I tend to stop buying things. I call it the cheese index. I don't buy feta cheese or goat cheese or smoked cheddar. I just stick to maybe mozzarella or, so that's kind of a joke with my husband.
Oh, so you'd stick to the blander cheese?
Yeah, the blander, cheaper cheeses. But the other question I had for your guest is, I was living in Texas during the Enron crash and then the kind of mini whatever we had in 2001.
Well, that was the dot-com crash.
Dot-com crash, yes. And one of the things I read, and it was in the Dallas Morning Star, but it was that the beauty, like Lancome and Estee Lauder, the beauty market and hair care and that kind of thing always does well in hard times. And I thought that was really odd because it's something that I don't do even in good times as much as I should or would like to.
And you'd think it might be one of those...
It's called it the lipstick index.
Is there a lipstick index, Tamar?
Well, that's interesting. There is the idea of the haircut index, which is also sort of counterintuitive. You'd think you'd cut out haircuts a little bit in bad times. But apparently, a lot of women cut off their hair and go to short hair, which needs a lot more care when the economy's bad.
Or maybe they're doing that Abe Lincoln thing with the bowl on the head and just the scissors around the bottom.
No, I don't know.
Well, the other thing is twice a month I let my kids have McDonald's. And that's even though I've heard McDonald's is doing so well. But
yes,
that's one other thing I'm also cutting out.
All right. Jennifer, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Yeah, Jenna, we did hear a report that McDonald's was doing well.
Yes, but there are also people who think that this is may sort of mean a return to more home-cooked family meals, more family time, less eating out altogether. But it's true that when it is going to be eating out, it's going to be pretty cheap fast food eating out.
What about crime? Is crime an indicator of bad times?
Yeah, property crime is very much an indicator. All kinds of property crime go up a lot. Also, less tolerance, more mental health problems and less tolerance of mental health problems. So there's more civil commitments of people whom you might otherwise have tolerated odd behavior from. In bad times, they get slapped into the hospital.
Joanne is on the line. Joanne calling us from Baltimore.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Go ahead, please.
I noticed that the pants I'm wearing today are very similar to the pants that I was wearing, this is giving away my age, back during the last gas crisis at the end of the 70s, which are straight legs. And actually, the really popular jeans now are called the skinny jeans, which are even a narrower leg.
So you think the bell bottoms are popular in good times?
Yeah. Think of the 60s and... You know, things were sort of loosening up from the 50s to the 60s, and then at the end of the 70s, suddenly it was the straight leg jeans and everything very, very narrow in the pants. And I don't know, it just occurred to me, but I don't know if that might, it could relate to how much fabric it takes to make the jeans.
It could. Tamar, that was one of the theories about the hemline index, is that in
right.
when times were bad, the hemlines dropped because they wanted to use more fabric to provide more work.
So maybe those jeans designers are scrimping now.
Could be. Joanne, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Email from Joseph in Washington County in Michigan. A friend of mine subscribes to the fast food index to gauge the health of the economy. His belief is that the fast food industry will notice even small cutbacks in frivolous spending by the public. In hard economic times, fast food restaurants will get rid of their lower performing employees. In lush economic times, the restaurants will expand their staff. So if your hamburger is awesome, then the economy is in the tank. If there are tons of people in the kitchen and your burger is cold, you can afford to go to a higher class. Restaurant. Well, that's another take on it. This from JP in Boston. My favorite economic indicator is the one cited by Warren Buffett, that indicator being men's underwear sales, the theory being that when the economy is down, men will tend to put off buying new underwear, and that women's underwear sales are not as good an indicator because women are more likely to keep buying underwear no matter what the current economic climate is. And that, well, that Warren Buffett index, that's a famous one. Tamar, did you look into it?
I do know about it. I think we may find that there's more gender equality and that the women are hanging on to their old underwear more, too.
Stephen in Wichita, Kansas writes, I work as an adjunct instructor in local colleges. When there are more jobs than I can do, the economy is doing poorly. People return to college when times are tough. And that's traditionally something that people do.
Absolutely. All kinds of trade school, night school, community college. People are lining up to go back to school. Because if you can't get a job, that's what you ought to do.
Let's see if we can squeeze in one last call. Val with us from Rochester in New York.
Yes, and thanks for taking my call. I feel blessed after 10 years of trying. I'm on. It's a great program.
Congratulations. You've got 30 seconds.
Mine is local and seasonal, but I noticed that in bad economic times, there are fewer outdoor Christmas lights than there are in good times.
So we'll have to wait, I guess, a couple of weeks to take the tenor of this season. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Val, and thanks for your persistence. We appreciate it. Tamar Lewin, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Tamar is a reporter for the New York Times. She was with us from our bureau in New York. There's a link to her article, A Hemline Index, updated on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Ira Flatow's here with Science Friday tomorrow. I'll be back on Monday. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.